Welcome to the Best of Science World. Today, we'll feature some of the most interesting conversations we've had on our program's one-on-one segments. So stay with us for this special edition of VOA's Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. When actor Alan Alda was 11 years old, he found himself quite fascinated with a flame burning at the end of a candle. Curious, he asked his teacher, "What's a flame?" Hoping for a clear and concise answer, the teacher instead came back at him with just a one-word answer, oxidation. Years later, Mr. Alda decided to challenge scientists around the world to explain what a flame is in terms that an 11-year-old could comprehend. That challenge was then called the Flame Challenge, named after that elusive question asked so long ago. I'd first like to know a little bit about the Flame Challenge. What is it and why is it called the Flame Challenge?
Well, it's a contest for scientists around the world. And it's called the Flame Challenge because when I was 11 years old, which was quite a while ago, back before the Punic Wars, and I was really curious about what a flame was. I studied a flame at the end of a candle for, must have been days, wondering what it was. So I finally went to a teacher, and I said, "What's a flame? What's going on in there?" And she said, "Oxidation." And that was it. That was all I heard. I'd never heard that word before, so it wasn't much of an explanation. Many years later, I was writing a guest editorial for Science magazine, and I realized it was all about communicating science, because I work very hard at helping scientists communicate better. And I realized they had a personal story to tell about communicating science, and it was that story about my teacher not really explaining the flame very well. And then I realized by the end of the article I had a contest, and I challenged scientists to come up with an explanation an 11-year-old could understand, and the contest would be judged by real 11-year-olds. And that really turned the tide, because we got a lot of entries, and we had 800 entries and 6,000 kids judging the entries.
Perhaps you've given a hint a little bit in your last answer there. I'm curious as to why it's easily understood by an 11-year-old. Why that particular age?
Well, you know, it just happened that way because I was 11 when I asked that question. It turns out, as we look at the 11-year-olds who are judging it, it seems they have a kind of special ability. They're in a special place in their lives where they still have the curiosity, the sort of unbridled curiosity of a kid, but they're beginning to take on the critical thinking of an adult. And so they're in a good position to both ask the question and judge the answers.
Why do you think it's important for scientists and medical experts to effectively communicate so that everyone can understand them?
I think scientists recognize, at least I'm getting this from the feedback we're getting and the enthusiasm they have for studying communication, I think they recognize that there are three big groups that need to be communicated with better. One is the public, because they're using the science and they're creating sometimes barriers to the science because they don't quite understand it. Or they're not asking the right questions to protect themselves against trends that may not be in their best interests. But they need to have a clear understanding of the science so they can ask good questions. The second group is legislators and policymakers. They routinely don't understand what the scientists are asking funding for. They don't understand it at a deep enough level anyway. And the third group that needs more clarity is other scientists when they're not in your exact field. I hear this from many scientists that they speak different languages to one another. Sometimes if they're in the same field but they're not in the same lab, they don't really communicate as well as they could. So that's holding back collaboration, I would think, holding back new inroads that can be made, because an awful lot of the things that are happening now that are breaking ground require the collaboration of a lot of people from a lot of different fields. And science, I'll tell you an example of why, how I think scientists recognize this, is that the Flame Challenge is being sponsored now by two very large organizations, the American Chemical Society, and the American Association for the Advancement of Science. These are large organizations with huge memberships that recognize that an innovative thing like the Flame Challenge can increase scientists' interest in trying to find out how they can communicate better. Because, you know, the contest is not it's confusing a little bit, because the kids are so endearing and they're so enthusiastic about learning. It looks like the contest is for the benefit of the kids in learning more about science. It's really for the benefit of the scientists to find out how hard it is to communicate something. So if they actually take on the challenge and say, all right, I'm going to give it a go. I'm going to try to see if I can explain something about time to an 11-year-old that will capture his interest and make him want to learn more. That act, that process of trying to make something complex clear, is a very good first step to saying, whoa, this is hard. How do I learn how to do this better? And the byproduct is the kids also learn, so they both learn from it.
That was actor, director, writer, and educator Alan Alda. Late last year, Mr. Alda issued his second Flame Challenge to scientists, and the question this time around was, what is time? Well, back about a month ago, on June 3rd, the winners of that challenge were announced. Nicholas Williams, who retired from a long career at the Lawrence Livermore National Lab in California, won the challenge in the written category. And Stephen McGuire, a Ph.D. candidate at the University of Ottawa, won the visual category. Another Flame Challenge will be issued later this year, and Alda is asking students between the ages of 9 and 12 for suggestions on what the next challenge question should be.
You're listening to The Best of Science World on The Voice of America.
Years ago, Leroy Hood, along with his colleagues at the California Institute of Technology, developed four instruments that helped pave the way for the successful mapping of the human genome. Dr. Hood's latest passion is in developing various strategies, technologies, and knowledge that he thinks will lead to new methods of how the science of medicine is practiced. He calls his new approach P4 Medicine, which stands for Predictive, Personalized, Preventative, and Participatory Medicine. Dr. Hood tells us about his revolutionary vision for health and medical care in the not-too-distant future. You see the future of medical health care in something called P4 Medicine. Now, what is P4 Medicine, and what does this approach entail?
P4 medicine actually is the convergence of three fundamental forces in medicine today. But to give you specific examples of what systems medicine is doing for us today is we can do a genome sequence for just a few $1,000s these days, and that allows you to identify the actionable variants that exist in your genome about which we can do something to improve your health. I had a friend at Microsoft who had osteoporosis in his late 30s. He got an analysis done, and it turned out he had a defect in a calcium transporting gene, and all he had to do to cure it was to take 20 times as much calcium. So wouldn't each of us just love to know what our actionable genes are and do something to improve their defects?
What are actionable genes?
Well, an actionable gene, it's a variant that causes a defect or a deficiency about which medicine can do something.
You talk about today's approach in medicine as being disease-focused as compared to something with the P4 system as being wellness-focused. Can you explain the differences there?
Classic evidence-based medicine is primarily interested in disease and studying disease in very large populations and attempting to understand how to make the diagnostic and therapeutic approaches that are efficient. What P4 medicine will be doing increasingly is focusing on optimizing wellness for the individual. And we can do this in a number of different ways. But the whole point is, if we have individuals focus on their wellness, can we have them avoid most of the diseases that they come up with, especially later in life? We save the healthcare system an enormous amount of money.
With this approach, you're considering environmental influences. Can you explain what that is?
Disease is caused really by two things. You can have defects in your genes, or you can have something come from the environment and cause a disease. For example, an infectious organism like the AIDS virus. And the key for systems medicine is to be able to understand what both of these contributions are, your genome contribution and your environmental contribution. And we've developed very powerful tools that my guess is in the future, each patient is going to be surrounded with billions of data points and will have the wherewithal to reduce all that data to simple hypotheses about optimizing wellness and minimizing disease, a really transformational approach to medicine.
You see genetics or this approach to medicine as being used to develop individualized drug targets, which you say would make drugs enormously less expensive. Can you explain this approach to developing medication for the individual?
For example, in cancer, we now can actually cut out the cancer, we can determine the genome sequence of the cancer, and we can identify in that cancer defective genes, which in some case we have therapeutic treatments. We have drugs that can actually reverse their effects. So what that means is we can look at the individual and give them exactly the drug that's going to work for them. Now, the important point to make is that doesn't mean every individual that has a melanoma cancer is going to need different drugs. Rather, there may be four or five different kinds of drugs that will work in melanoma, and we just need to know which type the patient is so that appropriate drug can be used. And if we can focus on the things that work, that will lead to, again, enormous cost savings in healthcare.
You had been saying something about that the P4 system will allow democratization of healthcare, and you see it benefiting the developing world as well. Can you explain what you mean by this?
One of the benefits of P4 medicine is it's going to dramatically reduce the cost of healthcare in the future. And my argument is, just as with the digitalization of communications and information technology, so there'll be a digitalization of medicine that will dramatically reduce healthcare costs. And when that happens, just as we've done with communications, we can transport that to the developing world and give them a medicine that they can afford, even at relatively low incomes. So the idea is, for the first time in the developing world, successful medicine is going to be available, and that's what I mean by the democratization of healthcare.
That was Dr. Leroy Hood, world-renowned and prize-winning scientist. When Attar Kaur was a young man attending college in his native India, like many college students, he didn't have much money, which meant that he had limited access to necessary but expensive textbooks. Today, he is a mechanical engineering professor at the University of South Florida, but he never forgot the hardships that he faced during those early years at college. To help engineering students with limited financial resources, Professor Kaur created a free online collection of college courseware. Professor Kaur tells us about it and what it offers to college students around the world.
I guess the first thing I'd like to ask you, Professor, is you've developed a free open courseware resource called Holistic Numerical Methods. Can you explain what this is and what does it involve?
It is a core course which we teach in engineering. It's called Numerical Methods. It's a course about solving mathematical problems approximately, because most of the engineering and science problems cannot be solved exactly. So this is what get the students introduced to. And what we have done for the last 11 or 12 years is to develop this open courseware. And what we have done is that we have developed many different types of resources for the same topic, so that students have the opportunity of learning the material in the fashion they want to. And another good thing about the resource is that it has been vetted by several universities. It has been assessed formally by about four universities, so that we can see that it works with different types of students, whether they belong to a large university or a small university or with different racial backgrounds and gender and so on and so forth.
Who is this available to?
It is available to anybody in the world. We put no restrictions. We don't even ask a person to log in or give us a password or anything like that. And that's the beauty of it, because if you take out all the stumbling blocks of getting a resource, which can be as simple as even having to log in and put in a password, you find that more people are willing to use that resource.
Is there a cost involved with this?
No, there is no cost.
So it's absolutely free?
Absolutely free.
Now, what can a web visitor expect to find at your site?
If they're taking a course in numerical methods, they can use it as a complementary resource. So if they're going into the classroom, they can go back into their dorms or into their homes and watch maybe a YouTube lecture on the same topic which their instructor is teaching them. They can take multiple choice question quizzes on the web itself, and it gives them feedback right away. They can look at a PowerPoint presentation. They can look at some anecdotal information about a particular numerical method. They can also look at real-world examples which are used to illustrate why, in the first place, do we need to learn these different numerical methods.
I understand that the basis of your courseware comes from a very personal experience.
I went to undergraduate school in India. It was way back in the mid-1970s. And we used to have these books, which we had to use as textbooks. But some of these textbooks were written by American authors, and they'll be extremely expensive for an Indian student to buy. So the library would keep a few books, which we could check out for the whole semester, but three or four students would have to share that book. So since we're a small college, the tests were given all on the same day. People would have to come up with a timetable that, hey, you use it from 2 to 4, I use it from 4 to 6, and things like that. So it did impact how well we learned a particular material.
Does this courseware that you've developed correspond with any particular class or college curriculum? Is it used with any particular course or class offered by colleges?
Yes. The course is called Numerical Methods. And it is a core class, not for all engineering majors, but for engineering majors like mechanical, civil, and in some cases electrical, and computer engineering. They teach this course as a core class. So if you go to any engineering school, about half of the engineering students will have to take that course.
What do you consider to be one of the most important components of developing online courseware or classes?
You have to give the student an opportunity of learning the same thing via different modes. So that could be a video, that could be a textbook chapter, that could be some anecdotal information. So once you give these multiple context opportunities, it has been proven by evidence-based research that people learn it better, and it also stays in the long-term memory better.
That was Professor Attar Kaur, who teaches mechanical engineering at the University of South Florida in Tampa, Florida.
This is the Best of Science World on VOA.
Government agencies, along with other organizations, are keeping an eye on threatening space objects such as asteroids. The B612 Foundation is a private, non-governmental organization that was founded back in 2001 by a group of notable scientists, including two former NASA astronauts. The foundation is working on a mission that they say will harness the power of science and technology to help protect our planet. Russell "Rusty" Schweikert, a former NASA astronaut and one of the founders of this organization, talks about the threat of near-Earth objects and how the B612 Foundation plans to help locate and protect Earth from these threats. Can you please tell us a little bit about the foundation, its work and mission?
What we're talking about here in general is early warning. That is, you got to know what's coming at you to protect yourself or prevent it or whatever. So what we're talking about is the early warning component of asteroid impacts. Now, there are two things that you can do. One is you can find the population of these things out there in space. And once you find them and plot their orbits, you can predict ahead 100 years whether something is going to hit you or not. At which time you then have the capability of preventing the impact by deflecting them. However, there's a second thing, what the guys at Hawaii are doing, John Tonry and Rob Jedeke, and that is a project called Atlas, and that's a last-minute warning system. In that case, what you're doing is finding asteroids just before they hit the Earth. And then, depending upon the size, you may have as little as a couple of days of warning, or if they're a bit bigger, you can have a week or a month or so of early warning, in which case you can then do evacuation. You don't have time to do a deflection. That takes a lot of time, a year, a decade or so. But you can preserve life by having an evacuation, very much like a hurricane evacuation or something like that. So there are two different things. One is the long-term early warning, which allows you to prevent impacts, and the other is the short-term warning, which allows you to save life.
Well, it leads me to my next question then, is with all the detection being done, are there any projects in place or any efforts in place that are working to address should an asteroid or a large object be found?
Yes. B612 Foundation started 12 years ago when a bunch of us, including Ed, Lou, and myself, and a bunch of other guys, got together because we knew that there were lots of asteroids being found, or at least many more asteroids were being found back then than much earlier, and yet no one was looking at what do you do about it when you find one that's got your address. We looked at and started all the work on deflection of asteroids, that is, preventing an impact once you know something's going to hit you if you have adequate early warning. Deflection's great, but we've got to pick up the early warning issue because it looks like NASA's not going to be able to do this for a long time because of the financial situation. But we decided as a nonprofit that public safety, the future of humanity, was worth making a real push for in terms of getting up the kind of a space telescope that would give us the 99% of objects out there, but we don't know where they are. With our Project Sentinel, we're going to launch an infrared space telescope that's going to be focused on finding those objects down to the size of about DA-14, which went by last Friday, which can, you know, they can wipe out a city if they hit. So we've got to find those and find them early enough that we can prevent their impacts by deflecting them.
What kind of technology has been developed to deflect these asteroids from the path of Earth?
There has been no technology developed. What we're really talking about is pretty simple, and you have to do it in two stages. It's not an either-or. There's not a best way. What you need is two different things. The first thing you do is run into it. You just rear-end it on the freeway. And we've already, in a sense, done that. We ran a spacecraft into a comet back in 2005 to see what the comet was made of, not to change its orbit. But by running into it, you actually will speed it up a little bit. If you run into it from the rear or if you run into it from the front, you're going to slow it down a little bit. And 10 years later, if you do that, it's not going to be in the intersection when the Earth is in the intersection of those two orbits. So that's what you need to do. Speed it up a little bit or slow it down a little bit, and you can do it by running into it. However, that's pretty rough because you don't know exactly how much change in velocity you're going to give it, and it's very important that you give it a precise new orbit and not just an approximate one. And therefore, the second thing you do is we call a gravity tractor. You pull up next to it with another spacecraft, which has very small little engines in it, and you basically hover in front of it or behind it. If you want to speed it up just a little bit, you hover in front of it. If you want to slow it down a bit, you hover behind it, and the mutual gravity between that hovering spacecraft and the asteroid will pull the asteroid toward the gravity tractor very, very slightly, but enough to make a precise change in the orbit, which is what we need to end up with. And those two things give you a deflection, but you have to know about it and have to do that a decade ahead of an impact. And that's why we need early warning.
That was former NASA astronaut and one of the founders of the B612 Foundation, Russell Rusty Schweikert. Thanks so much for listening. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I am Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us either online or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.